My name is Anthony Freud. I'm the General Director of Lyric Opera of Chicago, and I'd like to speak to you about Giacomo Puccini's opera, Tosca. The excerpts you will hear are from a Warner Classics recording made in 1953 and featuring Maria Callas as Tosca, Giuseppe Di Stefano as Cavaradossi, and Tito Gobbi as Baron Scarpia. Victor de Sabata conducts the chorus and orchestra of La Scala Milan. The original sound recordings of musical excerpts are used with permission of Warner Classics. And special thanks to Nicholas Ivor Martin for writing this commentary. Opera is sometimes characterized as a fusion of disparate artistic forms: music and theatre, sculpture, painting and architecture, costume design, dance. To quote Puccini's hero, Mario Cavaradossi, in the previous excerpt, opera discovers the hidden harmony of contrasting beauties. But Cavaradossi isn't talking about opera. He's a painter, creating a Madonna for a local Roman church. And the contrasting beauties that are reconciled by his brush are not art forms, but women. Specifically, his girlfriend, the famous opera singer Tosca, a brunette, and a pious blonde he has seen attending services. The painter thinks he has captured a perfect blend of the two women. But he's the only one who thinks that. When Tosca herself looks at the picture, she sees only the other woman. That other woman is the Marchesa Attavanti, and although she does not appear in the opera, it's she who has set in motion the events of the first act. She has not been coming to the church only to pray. Her brother Angelotti is a political prisoner, and she's arranged his escape. He will come to the church, where their family maintains a private chapel, to change clothes and pick up supplies before escaping the city. The next person to examine the painting closely is the evil police chief, Baron Scarpia, and he too only sees the blonde Attavanti, missing any resemblance to the brunette Tosca. Is Cavaradossi not as good a painter as he thinks? Possibly. But people don't always see what is right in front of them. Or rather, they see some things and not others. Almost every art form tells a story, and how that story is presented will change what the audience understands it to mean. This is true of all the arts, but particularly so of the performing arts, because the listener does not control the passage of time. If you read a page of a book and don't understand it or don't pay attention, you can turn the page back and start again. In theatre, music and opera, the performance rolls inexorably on, even when your mind wanders. Artists always choose what to emphasize when they tell a story, but conductors, singers, designers, musicians, and above all stage directors must not only decide what's important, but how to keep the audience's attention on it. It is simply not possible to present an opera without interpreting it. Tosca is set in Rome in June 1800. What does Rome in 1800 mean to an American audience in 2014? Well, it was a long time ago. The opera premiered in Rome 100 years later, in January 1900. For that audience, the Rome of 1800 was a place of beauty and romance, but also a place of strife and oppression. Rome in 1800 was a city built by an ancient republic as its capital to house a million inhabitants, yet home to a mere 100,000. Shepherds tended their flocks in the middle of ancient ruins. Rome in 1800 was also the capital of the Papal States, a religious monarchy ruled by popes for more than a millennium. And it was a city in the middle of a war zone, captured and recaptured by pre-Napoleonic France and the ultimately victorious alliance of England, Austria, Russia, and the Kingdom of Naples. The 100 years between the setting and the premiere had seen the fall of the Papal States, the Venetian Republic, the Kingdom of Naples, and ultimately the Duchy of Savoy, subsumed into the new Kingdom of Italy. It had been profoundly changed by the Napoleonic Wars, with global implications as far-reaching as the two world wars would have in the 20th century. Were Tosca a drawing room comedy, this might not matter. But Tosca is not an original work. For the story, Puccini and his librettists Luigi Illica and Giuseppe Giacosa adapted a play by the French playwright Victorien Sardou. Sardou wrote what he termed well-made plays. Whether they were in fact well-made or not can be argued. George Bernard Shaw thought Sardou was a hack, and his theory of playwriting pretentious and silly. He called it Sardoodledom. Sardou's gimmick, if I may call it that, was to convince his audience that each of his violent and shocking melodramas was based on a true story. He did this by filling his plays with real historical characters and details. We'll get to the faux historical context of Tosca later. It was written for the best-known actress of the day, Sarah Bernhardt, famous on both sides of the Atlantic for her larger-than-life stage presence, the Divine Sarah. Puccini's work is a great opera with many layers of meaning and interpretation. Sardou interpreted history. Sarah Bernhardt interpreted Sardou. Puccini, Illica, and Giacosa interpreted Sardou. We'll see that the opera team made some surprising changes, some of which significantly changed what Sardou's play was about, and some of which meant that certain parts of the opera simply don't make sense. Ultimately, I hope you will enjoy not only these layers, but the final layers added by a live performance. The production that Lyric will present in this coming season is directed by John Caird, a director with a strong vision and voice. Tosca's jealousy blinds her to the blended harmonies of her lover's Madonna. Scarpia is blinded by his bloodthirstiness. I hope we can learn to appreciate all of the harmonies in Puccini's masterpiece. I mentioned that Rome in 1800 was a time of war and crumbling empires. When you enter the theatre for the John Caird production, you will see a white curtain with a hint of blood on it. We tend to forget that Tosca is set at the epicentre of the Napoleonic Wars. The opera opens a few minutes before noon on June 17, 1800, at which time Rome was under occupation by soldiers of the Kingdom of Naples. This was the fourth time it had changed hands in 2 years. Pope Pius is dead. So although Rome is, for the moment, again the capital of the Papal States, there is no Pope. With the opening notes of the opera, the curtain is torn away by Cesare Angelotti, an escaped prisoner. Each time Rome changed hands, the conquering army took its revenge on those who had sided with the previous regime. As an official of the Roman Republic, Angelotti is lucky to be alive. The first thing we see is the portrait the hero Mario Cavaradossi is painting of Angelotti's sister, the Marchesa Attavanti. But this is no ordinary religious icon. It is fractured into disconnected pieces, an eye, a lip, reminding us of the violence around it. Angelotti has come to the church in search of food and clothing that his sister has left for him. He hides in the family chapel. Cavaradossi soon returns to work on his painting. I mentioned that the opera begins a few minutes before noon. How do I know? A few minutes after Cavaradossi returns, the sacristan begins to recite the words of the Angelus Domini prayer. Hearing him, Cavaradossi asks a two-word question. Che fai? What are you doing? This means nothing to a modern audience, but the Roman audience at Puccini's premiere would have recognized the Angelus as a traditional noontime prayer, and they would further have realized that Cavaradossi's question shows him to be a foreigner and possibly an atheist. He's both. Although the son of a noble Roman father, Cavaradossi was raised in Paris by his French mother and has only recently returned to Rome. Puccini has used his knowledge of Roman custom and the familiarity of his audience with those customs to convey in two words information that required half a scene in the Sardou play. The exchange is not taken from the Sardou original, any more than is the bloody curtain or the fractured Madonna of the lyric production, but all three elicit important points about the story with great economy of means. Cavaradossi's position in Rome is not uncommon. It was understood that an artist might wish to come to the Eternal City to further his studies. But this painter is in a vulnerable position. The city is under Allied occupation. The French are the enemy. It is therefore all the more surprising when Angelotti comes out of hiding once the sacristan has left that the painter agrees to help him. Any amnesty Cavaradossi has as an artist is unlikely to be respected if he is discovered aiding the flight of a political prisoner. This is an important point for Sardou, but one that held little interest for Puccini. According to the French playwright, Angelotti and Cavaradossi are strangers. The escaped prisoner takes a chance because after overhearing the painter's discussion with the sacristan, he realizes that they share the same political convictions. Puccini changes their relationship in the opera. Angelotti and Cavaradossi are old friends. This does not lessen the risk Cavaradossi is taking, but it makes it personal and not political. It also doesn't make much sense. How exactly did the two meet? Angelotti spent his life in England and Italy, Cavaradossi in France. And if you haven't heard, there is a war on. We are told repeatedly that Cavaradossi didn't know the woman whom he had painted into his Madonna. If he just arrived in Rome and doesn't know anyone in the city, this makes sense. But Attavanti is Angelotti's sister. Perhaps when they were discussing politics, Angelotti forgot to mention her. The reason for the change, however, is the necessity of theatre. The explanation above took time, just as it takes time in the Sardou play. And Puccini has too much material to get through. Ah, my old friend, you're in trouble. Let me help. Puccini's way is quicker. In any version, Cavaradossi knows at least one person in town well, his lover, the famous opera singer Floria Tosca. Tosca is a jealous hothead, and when she pays Cavaradossi a visit in the church, she's upset that he is using the beautiful Attavanti as his Madonna. Listen to the vehemence of her response when she recognizes l'Attavanti, the countess. This is an operatic woman. Cavaradossi reassures Tosca of his love and hurries her out the door. Angelotti, who has been hiding all this time, emerges as a cannon is fired. It's the prearranged signal that a prisoner has escaped from the Castel Sant'Angelo. This was not part of the plan, and the two men now improvise. "Go to my house," Cavaradossi instructs Angelotti. "If anyone comes to the door, there is a well in the garden with a secret compartment. You can hide there." The act ends with the arrival of the villain of the piece, Baron Scarpia. Scarpia is the chief of police and is therefore tasked with recapturing Angelotti. After finding the prisoner's discarded clothes and a fan with the crest of the Marchesa Attavanti, Scarpia knows he's on the right trail. The portrait of the Madonna and its uncanny resemblance to Attavanti convinces him that Cavaradossi is involved. Scarpia uses the fan to fan Tosca's jealousy, hoping he will lead her to the prisoner. Scarpia has a second goal. Like everyone else in Europe, he wants the beautiful Tosca for himself. The church is offering a special mass to celebrate the news that has just arrived of an Allied victory over the French at Marengo. The act ends with this mass, over which we hear Scarpia chillingly admit that even in the middle of a most sacred church rite, Tosca makes him forget God. Just as with Act 1, Act 2 opens with a bloody curtain torn away by Scarpia, who is daydreaming of his lust for Tosca. Listen to Puccini's music, which is almost gentle. But don't be fooled. Scarpia is essentially fantasizing about raping the singer. We're in the Palazzo Farnese, a palace owned by popes and kings of Naples for generations. This is usually depicted on stage as an opulent apartment, in keeping with Puccini's directions in the score. But who is the chief of police to rate such an apartment? In the Sardou play, Scarpia's apartment is in the prison, the Castel Sant'Angelo of Act 3. We know from Sardou that Scarpia is a Neapolitan brought in by the King and Queen of Naples to restore order in Rome. He's been in the city for only 8 days. The set for the John Caird production is not typical for the opera, whose score specifies 3 distinct, well-known locations: the Church of San Andrea della Valle for Act 1, the Palazzo Farnese adjoining the Campo dei Fiori for Act 2, and the ramparts of the Castel Sant'Angelo for Act 3. Caird uses a single box set, decorated differently to capture the essence of each act. For Act 2, the set is dominated by boxes on which are perched stolen art. The boxes and the art carry with them a host of insights into the opera. That Scarpia is not a lover of art, but a soulless stockpiler. That he's a figure of brutality, not elegance. Scarpia's men have been unsuccessful in locating Angelotti. In his place, they have arrested Cavaradossi. When the painter refuses to betray his friend Angelotti, Scarpia invites Tosca in and gives her a choice: tell what she knows or watch her lover be tortured. Both Sardou and Puccini place the torture offstage, and for a similar reason, to keep the focus on Tosca. Sardou wrote his play for Bernhardt, who could be counted on to out-act any fake stage blood. And both author and composer had to bow to 19th-century sensibilities. A story including 2 suicides, a murder, a near-rape, and an execution was challenging enough. Caird leaves Cavaradossi on stage, but partially out of sight, making the brutality even more apparent. When Tosca relents and gives away Angelotti's hiding place, Scarpia orders the torture stopped. Tosca soothes his wounds and lies to him, assuring him that she kept his secret. But Scarpia exposes her almost immediately, revealing to Cavaradossi that Tosca has betrayed him. The painter is furious. As Cavaradossi vents his wrath on Tosca, news arrives that the battle at Marengo was not a defeat for the French after all, but a victory. Melas, the allied Austrian general, has fled the field of battle. And it is historical record that the battle was initially reported in Rome as an allied victory. Marengo resulted in the Austrian evacuation of northwestern Italy, and it strengthened the position of the victorious French general Napoleon Bonaparte as the country's new first consul. Cavaradossi reacts to the news of a French victory with unmistakable joy.
Nel pozzo del giardino va Spoletta!
Victoria!
We may wonder about this outburst of enthusiasm for a dictator who waged war on a continental scale for 12 years and nearly conquered Europe. Cavaradossi is half French, so his motivation is clear. And Sardou was 100% French. But we have to remember that Napoleon was a hero to many outside of France, the savior and embodiment of the French Revolution, which declared, even if it didn't always practice, liberty, equality, and fraternity. Scarpia, Naples, and Austria were monarchist, allied with the Tsar of Russia and the King of England. Having openly declared his allegiance, Cavaradossi can no longer claim to be personally neutral, and Scarpia has him arrested. He is not the only artist whose art no longer protects him. Tosca tries to bribe Scarpia, but he only laughs. He will release Cavaradossi, he says, but only if Tosca sleeps with him. In the showpiece aria of the opera, Tosca laments that she lived only for art and for love. Visi d'arte is a difficult aria to realize, and not only because of its vocal challenges. Art may be central to the life of the singer Tosca, but it is not a focal point of the opera Tosca. The opera is about oppression, power and its abuse, and political liberty. But Tosca being a singer and Cavaradossi being a painter are largely irrelevant. By having Scarpia looting Roman antiquities, director John Caird makes a link between art and the larger themes of the opera. Tosca herself becomes yet another work of art in Scarpia's looted hoard. And Caird reminds us that artistic expression and political freedom are related. Scarpia's men report that they found Angelotti but were unable to take him alive. Angelotti killed himself. Scarpia orders his men to hang Angelotti's lifeless body on a gibbet. We know from Sardou's play that Tosca began as a poor shepherdess and was taken into a convent. There she was taught music, and in another of Sardou's attempts to use historical characters to make his play more real, meets the composer Domenico Cimarosa. It is Cimarosa who launches Tosca's career as an opera singer. Tosca has just betrayed Cavaradossi and lied to him about it, after which she has attempted to bribe a public official. Her reasons were understandable and compelling, but her convent training appears to have been forgotten. Tosca is also carrying on a sexual liaison with Cavaradossi, a point Puccini glosses over, but which Sardou emphasizes. Sardou's Tosca admits that the liaison endangers her own salvation. Worse sins are yet to come. After Scarpia writes out passports for Cavaradossi and Tosca, he goes to claim his reward, only to be stabbed with a knife from his own dinner table.
Tosca, finalmente mia! Maledetta!
The act ends with Tosca placing candles around Scarpia's lifeless body in a futile attempt to give religious sanction to her act. Act 3 again opens with the bloody curtain, this time torn away by a young girl, the innocent shepherdess Tosca once was. Cavaradossi is a prisoner in Castel Sant'Angelo, awaiting execution, and we hear the shepherdess singing a poem in Roman dialect. Unlike many productions, in this Tosca, Cavaradossi is not alone. he greets his fellow prisoners, recognizing some. The prisoners are now forced to watch as Angelotti's lifeless body is hanged in the prison square as Scarpia had instructed. This act of senseless brutality reminds us of centuries of wartime atrocities, but it also brings us back to the Sardou original. Remember that Scarpia had been in Rome only 8 days, and we also know that Angelotti has been in prison for a year since Rome was retaken by the King of Naples. How is it that Angelotti escaped on this particular day? We know his sister was involved because she left him clothes in the church, and we know from the painting and Tosca's jealousy that the Marchesa is beautiful. Starting to see a pattern? This may not be the first time that Scarpia engineered an escape in return for the favours of a beautiful woman. In the play, Cavaradossi is asked about Scarpia and responds, "What woman, daughter or sister has not paid with her honour for coming near this impure satyr?" Also in the play, the Queen of Naples recommends to Scarpia that he recapture Angelotti quickly before anyone proves what she suspects. When Scarpia promises to do so, the Queen answers, "So much the better for you, because it would not be good to put the King in a bad mood." No one is safe in a totalitarian state, not even someone as powerful and ruthless as Scarpia. By hanging the lifeless Angelotti, Scarpia is protecting himself. Tosca comes to the prison to give Cavaradossi the good news. According to her deal with Scarpia, Cavaradossi's execution will be a sham, after which they will be free to go. Tosca agreed to the sham because she understands that Scarpia reports to a higher authority. What she does not understand is that Scarpia has double-crossed her. The firing squad uses real bullets, and Cavaradossi is killed. Discovering the body, Tosca, in our production, pulls out the knife with which she killed Scarpia. Evil though he was, Tosca knows that her other sins are nothing compared to murder. Rather than be captured by Scarpia's men, she slits her own throat and falls lifeless from the turret of the Castel Sant'Angelo onto the pavement below. This is not, as I'm sure you know, how the opera usually ends. Puccini calls for Tosca's fall to cause her death. But in doing so, Puccini leaves a problem for the director. Tosca's death is the climactic moment of the opera. If she's already thrown herself off the parapet and is therefore out of sight, why is the orchestra still playing? Isn't the opera over? Directors must grapple with the same issue in Puccini's Madama Butterfly and in his La Bohème. Keeping the diva on stage keeps the audience's attention focused on her while the music plays inexorably out. And Caird's ending adds another insight. The weapon Tosca used to commit the sin can also be used to redeem it. Her final flourish, telling Scarpia's men that she will greet Scarpia before God, becomes her recognition that no matter what Scarpia did, she will herself have to answer for her actions.